You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Hello, welcome please to Telstra Customer Service. How may I be helping you?
Conform or be consumed.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history.
I heard a rumour today.
I like your rumours.
I know, as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
What is your environmental policy?
To sell Telstra.
You heard of road rage?
Yes.
What about web rage?
And within a few minutes.
Minutes?
Yeah, minutes. It's not minutes. XG, mate.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. For years now, the internet has become more and more media rich. From what used to be a text-based world in the domain of geeks and men who wore white coats, to now, where internet users consist of nearly everyone on the planet of every age, nationality, and almost independent of wealth, the net has truly become worldwide, catering for everything and everybody. Today's online experience is more than computer-based. We can take it with us in the form of a third-generation mobile phone or a portable digital assistant. We even use the internet for making phone calls at prices so cheap it's almost free. What the traditional telephone did for mankind, the internet is about to do again, if it hasn't already done so. Never before have we been so connected. We're truly a global village. Today, if you're not online, you're in the shrinking minority. We can access the online world via the telephone line, radio waves and satellites. So regardless of speed and location, online access is close by. In an age where consumerism is running rampant and outputs are no longer measured by monetary value, rather tons of carbon, one has to wonder where we'll be in 20 years' time. The internet promises to get bigger and faster as more and more consumer services become available online. No longer do we need to get in the car and go to the shops. We can find everything we want online in the global shopping centre. When was the last time you went inside a bank? And what was the last bill you paid by writing a cheque and walking to the mailbox on the corner to post it? And what is a cheque anyway? The communications revolution of the 21st century will be unrelenting. Never before have we seen social change in such a short period of time. The revolution promises many surprises. Are you ready?
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
Apple takes on Microsoft and Firefox. Adam Turner has a telescope next to the couch this week and peeks at Pluto. We take a look at a sport which requires a four-wheel drive, GPS navigation and radio receivers. US authorities swoop on MySpace. IT glitches threaten the International Space Station. Microsoft plugs a few more security holes. eBay fights for Buy It Now. And YouTube tests video fingerprints. All that and more on Australia's premier tech talk show, Tech Talk Radio. But first, let's find out what's been making news in the IT world this week.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, International Space Station computers partially restored, Apple releases Safari web browser for Windows, Kodak creates a new low-light imaging technology, Google announces a reduction in data retention, and text messages fight crime in Boston. Welcome to Tech Talk News. In unprecedented drama aboard the International Space Station, Russian computer systems controlling navigation and environmental factors such as onboard water supply ceased functioning after the installation of a large solar array last week. NASA officials believe the failure could be due to the computer's electrical system and that an electromagnetic field created by the new solar array might be causing disruptions to these electronics. The computer system, which has been in operation for nearly 7 years, controls orbit, guidance, navigation, and mission management systems aboard the International Space Station. On top of these unexpected difficulties, mission specialists Danny Olivas and Jim Riley were forced to undertake repair work to a thermal blanket aboard the Space Shuttle Atlantis last week. The shuttle is currently docked with the International Space Station and is providing control of its orientation by thrusting small jets, while the ISS computer systems are inoperative. Mike Suffredini, NASA's International Space Station Program Manager, said last week that computer functionality had been partially restored and stressed that he believed the issue will be solved in the next few days. In a first for PC users, Apple released a version of its popular Safari web browser for Windows users last week and said that users have downloaded more than 1 million copies in the first 48 hours of it being available. The Safari 3 public beta is now available for download from Apple's website and claims to be the fastest web browser on any platform, with pop-up blocking, tabbed browsing, and a built-in RSS reader. But many Windows users reported difficulties with the new Apple web browser, complaining that no text was displayed on websites or Safari toolbars, only images. Additionally, several security vulnerabilities were found, and Apple was forced to issue an update, version 3.0.1, to address these concerns on Thursday. Apple has pointed out that the browser download is still a beta test version and is yet to include several new features, including support for international users, international text input methods, tooltips, and spell checking. Kodak has announced the creation of a new imaging technology that can at least double the sensitivity of image sensors in digital cameras. The colour filter technology is still a year off being used in digital cameras and mobile phones, but will enable photographers to take better pictures in low light. Chris McNeef, general manager of Kodak Eastman's image sensor business, told The Age last week that the company was talking about a 2 to 4 times improvement in light sensitivity. The technology will replace an industry-standard filter pattern, also designed by Kodak in 1976, and represents a breakthrough in boosting photo quality. Kodak expects to incorporate the technology in point-and-shoot cameras and camera-equipped mobile phones sometime next year. Google was applauded last week by the European Union's top security official for its decision to scale back the time it keeps personally identifiable data accumulated from search engine queries and web users. The move was hailed as a step forward over recent concerns that Google was failing to respect EU privacy rules. Google said last week it was prepared to reduce the time it stored user data to 1.5 years, which was the low end of an 18 to 24 month period it had originally proposed to EU regulators in March. EU Justice and Security Commissioner Franco Frattini told a news conference in Luxembourg last week that the announcement was indeed a good step and that it was good to see Google trying to meet EU expectations. Mr. Frattini also welcomed Google's announcement to explore ways to redesign cookies and reduce their expiration on users' computers. And Reuters reported last week that Boston police have turned to anonymous text messaging in an effort to curb an increase in violent crime. Boston Police Commissioner Edward Davis said the Text a Tip program, announced on Friday last week, appeared to be the first in the United States to combine cell phone text messaging with an anonymous police tip line. Mr. Davis said the text-a-tip program was more anonymous than a telephone call where you have to have a conversation with someone, and that a traditional Crime Stoppers tip line using a toll-free telephone number was becoming obsolete. The mobile messaging application is enabled by VeriSign and provides a direct connection from mobile carriers to Boston Police. And that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
It's rather lonely in the studio, isn't it? Well, I mean, present company excluded, of course. It's lovely to be here with you. But wireless energy transfer. What on earth? We were talking about this during the week.
I'm loving this story.
Isn't it great?
It is.
So it might work like a wireless hotspot does in a similar way. It has a coverage area and you have a device which you plug in and then it can transmit the energy to the devices which will receive it.
Exactly.
If my monitor blows up today, it goes out on the nature strip. I go down to Officeworks, I buy a new one for $99.95.
The other big application for this is going to be cell phones, PDAs, MP3 players.
These pieces of technology have become disposable.
Main engine cutoff confirmed, 8 minutes 35 seconds into the flight.
I had to force myself to read that bit in the news, but...
The Tribune managed to compile a directory of more than 2,600 CIA employees.
Yeah, there's one photo of Tony Blair on the website drinking from one of our coffee mugs, which is absolutely wonderful.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Yeah.
Very good evening to you all. Welcome to Tech Talk Radio for this week. Hello, I'm back. Thanks to Dr. Ron Graham Callaghan, who put in a superlative effort last week as Mark and I traversed the terrain of South Australia's Mount Gambier, which was a lot of fun. So anyway, well, more about that later this evening. But what a week in news. What a day in news. It all happened all so quickly here. We're talking about broadband, all sorts of things. We're going to touch briefly on all that sort of stuff. But first, Dr. Ron, thanks for filling in for me last week.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the opportunity. It was a lot of fun.
Well, good. Good. Yeah. You know, these buttons all look a bit foreign, even when you haven't done it for a week. Which one do I push now? I think Graham was pushing the buttons, weren't you?
I pushed a couple of buttons. I pushed a few right ones and a couple of wrong ones.
Oh, yeah, good. No, that's sort of par for the course. And, I think I sort of heard most of the show. I think it came across really, really well. So well done, boys.
Oh, very good. Glad you enjoyed it.
It was a lot of fun.
Listen to it, isn't it, when you're not involved in it?
It is. What's coming up next?
Yeah.
All right. Now, tonight's show is action-packed. I hope we can fit it all in. So maybe we should apologise from the head and say if we leave anything out, I'm sorry, you'll have to come back and listen to the podcast. And by the way, if you're listening to the one-hour show, there is a two-hour. There's an extended mixed version available via the website, too. You can come and download it and have a bit of a listen to it.
Hi, Mark, on the other side of the room. I haven't seen you for weeks and weeks.
It has been like that, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Now I'm back and trying to catch up with my technology news.
Did you have fun, though? We're going to hear all about your escapades, but
absolutely.
You had a good time?
Probably had more fun than the last few years, actually.
Oh, good.
No pressure.
Good.
We'll talk all about that. If you want to know how to mix a bit of four-wheel driving, GPS, satellite navigation, radio communications, everything into the one, have a lot of fun and laugh and carry on, we'll tell you how to do it because that's what we did on the weekend. Where should we start tonight, boys? Let's not go on the rundown. Let's talk about what was announced just recently, if you're listening to us in another state. The federal government has finally given a go-ahead to Optus to run wireless technology out to the rural side of the country instead of what we're going to see potentially in here, which will be a fibre to the node. They've gone wireless out in the country. Now, we've got a lot of people in the studio who are pretty, I think, expert in the field here. Is this going to be a good or a bad thing? Now, I'm going to put a little bit of, credibility on the line here and say, I think we're, about 5-6 months away from a federal election. There's a lot of spin going on at the moment between the two parties. And I guess we don't really want to talk about the politics of it tonight. What I'd like to talk about is actually the technology itself. Now, WiMAX, we've spoken about WiMAX, and it's been fairly, I guess, quiet of late. Any of you guys got any further updates on WiMAX and what's going to happen? Because this is the technology that they're planning on rolling out.
Well, I think Mark would be the person to comment on this. How does WiMAX work?
It's not what part of the mobile phone network, is it? Because that's what everyone's sort of thinking. How are they going to get this technology out? Or is it? It sits on top of something.
It's an extension to Wi-Fi, I guess, you'd say. It's interesting because it has got mobility function in WiMAX, which Wi-Fi sort of doesn't have. You can't change between cells.
So you have to stay still for it. Is that what you're saying?
No, Wi-Fi you sort of had to stay still, but WiMAX you don't have to.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's getting a bit of a roll on in the States now. So I've got a friend who's rolling out a WiMAX network in the Boston area of the States.
Mm-hmm.
And he's telling me what it is, how it's going, that sort of thing. He's coming across the similar issues that we've had with the NextG network rollout, where you need to have a lot of sites, you've got to roll it out with it needs to be a fast rollout, which means you want to use existing infrastructure as much as you can. But it's interesting that it runs at 2.5 gigahertz, and we've talked about this in the past. I know the one in the States runs at 2.5 gig. I haven't heard what this frequency is going to be for the one in Australia, but if it is 2.5 gig, how are you going to get it to go the distance? The radio waves, don't travel as far when they're at higher frequencies.
Mark, am I right in saying that people have found WiMAX has a niche market in linking Wi-Fi hotspots together, or do subscribers actually have WiMAX equipment in their homes?
It's too new. Like, they're literally, I think there might be one market in the States who have launched. This one that I'm involved with, or keeping in touch with, won't launch till next year. They're only in the development, the design phase of where the sites are going, and trying to do their infill site. So they've got a network running IDEN system, which is around the 800, 900 megahertz area. And obviously they need like three times as many sites as that because they're running up at 2.5 gigahertz. It's going to be interesting to see what happens when they're trying to run it out in rural Australia where they want lots of distance and lots of speed.
Well, on that same topic, if it's a question of the distance and the amount of physical real estate it can cover. This one you're watching in Boston, I think you said. Mm-hmm. You're talking the Boston CBD, you're talking about the metro area, you're talking about greater metro suburbs and all suburban areas and all that?
It is the greater metro area.
Okay, so it's a fairly big area then.
Yeah. I guess I don't know if I can give out figures, you know, in case, you know, it's been told to me in confidence sort of thing, but, you know, it's not just
but it
just
would be
CBD.
Comparable to the greater metro area of an Australian major capital.
Yes, that's correct.
So if you look at the technology, this is WiMAX. It's not really out there yet. So we're going to... I think Intel were behind this,
well,
if
not many people,
I recall.
Yeah, that's
they?
Right. Intel have got a lot of money behind it. But there's not a lot of people making devices for it.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one or two manufacturers actually making the base stations for it at the moment, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the base stations, some of them I was heard today, now I don't know how factual this is, but they only put out 1 watt of power, which is not a lot when you've got to go a great distance. You know, typical base stations put out 50 watts. So I think that is considerably
weaker than your average base station, I guess. It's going to be interesting to see if they've really...
Certainly will be.
...put their...
And how much of that $1.8 billion is going to be spent on, you know, that, what... 2%, 5% of people where they're going to use wireless to get the last little bit. Now, we've got people who are using what's called wireless local loop at the moment. That's their universal service obligation phone. You know, they're using radio to get it, and it runs on sort of like the CDMA network sort of thing. They've got very tall masts on their stations, you know, guide masts and battery power and all this sort of thing, and moved away from buildings and that. It's not as though you can send it out to a guy on a courier and say, install this yourself, you know. These sort of stations require tall poles with antennas pointing the right direction and all tuned up and coax runs and, you know, before you get it. So, you know, you'll have to have someone go out there to do it. That's going to be expensive for them to roll out.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, do some serious speculation, which is what Tech Talk Radio is all about and stands for. I suspect the federal government has given Optus the rural side of things because they're going to give Telstra the fibre side of things in the cities. Now, I don't know whether I'm going out on a limb here or what. Maybe I am. But I think it's good politics that they're setting up here in an election year, because there was no sign of Mr. Burgess today. Did anyone hear him on the radio at all? No? No, exactly.
I was noticing something on the ABC website, so there might have been something from Telstra, but whether it was from him...
No, I don't think it was from Phil at all, so I suspect...
it'll be coming, I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
You can guarantee that. But yes, there has to be another leg to this.
That's my speculation. I reckon we'll see Telstra get the fibre to the node go ahead.
Which probably makes sense, because Telstra have got that last bit of cable from the node, the pillar box, to the homes.
I've got a few concerns about fibre to the node too, in respect to a monopoly, but we'll wait and see what happens there, and I think that's a discussion for another show as their plans get released a little bit. But
this technology makes sense as well for rural and country customers too. It's wireless technology.
Exactly.
We can't really go down the fibre path. It is cost prohibitive.
Oh, you couldn't put fibre to all the rural areas, but I'm not sure that wireless is the right solution as well as a primary solution. Wireless you use to fill in the gaps, as the base network.
I think you'll find some of the rural centres, the bigger rural centres, will probably get the option of fibre to the node. You look at the Bendigos, Ballarat, Cairns, you know, those sort of...
Well, I heard today that they're buying 360 D-slams. So, for this rollout.
360, that doesn't sound a lot, really, does it?
I don't know. I'm not sure, but I'm just trying to say, I'm trying to get the feel for how much is wireless. I know they've mentioned wireless, but I believe that it might only be to 2% of customers, 5%, 10%. It's not going to be to the majority of customers, you know.
That would make more sense.
Yeah, so I'm just curious as to the breakup yet, you know.
More to come.
So from a technological point of view, I agree. I think wireless in certain regional areas is going to be good, but just purely because of the tyranny of distance and the cost prohibitiveness of running a piece of blue cable up a street and digging a hole in the ground. I just have a sneaking that there'll be another announcement fairly shortly in respect to the fibre to the node and... Watch this space, I guess.
Yeah, interesting. 12 megabits per second was quoted.
Which isn't fast if you're thinking of future-proofing a network, but Senator Coonan was saying 70. Senator Coonan says the technology is expandable to 70 megabits per second.
Well, that's true on the wireless side of things, but I'm worrying about the ADSL side of things. How do you get the 70 megabits or even the 12 megabits on ADSL 1, you know, which... You know, to go those extra distances, you don't get 12
megabits. 12 megabits is a reasonable sort of median figure for ADSL 2, ADSL 2+.
Okay, so let's say they went ADSL 2 pass. Where would you get 12 megabits per second? At what distance?
Yeah, I get it at the office quite easily. I'm about a kilometre away from the exchange. In fact, I get 21 megabits per second down.
I mean, you'd have to have your DSLAM, what, 1 kilometre away from a... You know, we're talking...
Well, it depends. If you're 20 kilometres away from a rural exchange, you're going to have some problems there, aren't
That's
you?
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
That's
right. Yeah, so there's a lot behind it. Now, for people trying to work out what we're talking about, when we talk about megabits per second, that's the amount, that's the size of the pipe. It's like bringing water into your home. If you've got a thin pipe, it's not going to be, you know, you're not going to get
your
water
pressure will be low. Yeah,
exactly. And it's the same thing we're talking about here. As the internet moves to being a media-rich environment, we need to pull more and more, or the pressure of water, as we say in the water side of things, needs to be a tad higher.
That's right.
For it all to work. So 12 megabits per second, yes, based on what we have today, is a lot. But in 2, 3, 4 years' time, when everybody wants, you know, GooTube's gone the next level and they're streaming really good stuff and
high def video and, yeah, all that
and
sort
video
of
on demand and all that sort of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're a juiced person, Dr. Ron?
I've tried juice, but it's something which we're going to see more and more of and people are going to be using more and more.
So I think...
Having said that, though, if you lived in the country and you had very poor dial-up at the moment, you'd be wrapped to get 12 megabits. If they could deliver on 12 megabits, you'd be wrapped, you know.
So are we getting too finicky here? Do you think... We're going to have a digital divide, I think, regardless of what we do. And this revolution that we're seeing right now unfold is certainly going to set the scene and the pace of what happens here in Australia, from a business point of view, too. Once again, just an anecdote I'll talk about now. We're looking for new business premises, and the decision on where we get that premises is determined by whether ADSL 2 is available there. So, you know, the poor real estate agent, when you ask him the question, he looks at you blankly and says, oh, what?
But that's going to be a situation that's going to happen more and more. So
exactly. But look at what we're missing out on because, you know, Telstra have ADSL 2 in their exchanges, but they're not turning the switch on until there's someone to compete with.
Yep.
And this is the frustrating thing, you know, the local where I was trying to get this office, it's there, but they haven't turned it on. And as a result, it's affecting my business. So I don't think I'm Robinson Crusoe. I think a lot of other people out there in the real world will be sadly moving around trying to find where they can get good internet, even in the rural side of things, as opposed to here in the cities.
Yep, spot on.
We were in Mount Gambier on the weekend. I think we saw ADSL 2 over there that was pumping away through, you know, little country real estate spots like that. Even in Ballarat when we drove through there, there was a big sign on a window saying ADSL 2.
Mm-hmm.
Admittedly, it was across the road from the telephone exchange. But
you'd hope it would be available there.
Indeed. All right. Well, speaking of internet and things like that, it really is changing our lifestyle a lot. I think I was reminiscing over the weekend about what we had, life before mobile phones, life before data, you know, the old Odie Cologne, the old Twisted Pair, as they used to call them, those old acronyms. It was a revolution when that came along, and the rollout of that seemed to go relatively well, would you say? The Postmaster General's office rolled it out quite well, and here we are down the other end of the spectrum where everything, if you're not on broadband these days, if you don't have access to broadband, you're in a very small minority, getting smaller and smaller. So, guys, what sort of was the turning point for you with broadband, I guess, is my question. Where did you think that, hey, I can't live without this, this is good?
I can remember thinking that when I first got my Optus cable. Now, I'm going back to...
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a year, 1996 or 1997, something.
Do you remember
like
Optus cable? Because you and I got it similarly, fairly close times.
We did.
And it was uncapped both ways.
Yes, and it was... we were getting... was it 3 gigabytes a month we were allowed to use,
or something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a good time, wasn't it, before the heavies came in and said, no, you can't do this, you can't do that.
Indeed. Yes, that's right. No, it was a lot of fun, and it was... I can remember saying to a lot of people, this is fantastic, having been in 56K dial-up hell for so many years.
But 56K, that was better than 28K.
Well, it was. There was a sort of a marginal improvement every time you upgraded your modem from, you know, 4800 to 96 to 14.4 and then to 28.8 and then 56K. But I can remember thinking when I'd got Optus cable, yeah, this is it. This is really good. I cannot go back now. I'd have to cut off my right arm before I actually ditch the high-speed internet. And then we moved to other technologies. We moved to ADSL and other things for different reasons. But I think that was a turning point for me.
I remember the day. We had a staff offer at Telstra where you could get broadband on ADSL for about a quarter of the cost. of what retail people. And it was a 6-month trial, and you had to put up with the service going off, and had to do a few things for
Nothing's
them.
Nothing's changed.
Yeah, that's right. But it was a separate server, and that, you knew that when you took it on. That's why you got it cheap.
Was it on Big Pond Cable, Mark?
No, it was on ADSL.
Righto.
At the time.
Yep.
And 6 months down the track, you know, it reverted back to a normal one. You could keep it and that sort of thing. And you know, I said to my wife, "Do we still want it?" She said no, and so we turned it off. Not even a month later, she said, "I can't handle this. This dial-up's just way too slow." And yeah. I know the internet had progressed, but we just went back to our normal dial-up, and she gave me the green light to go and get broadband.
There you go. I had a slightly different perspective on that changeover, because for a long time I had a permanent dial-up connection that stayed connected all the time. So initially, a lot of the push to go to broadband when broadband first came in was because the broadband connection was always on. And that was one of the big features of it, that you didn't have to wait for the modem to connect and then disconnect it later.
It was a great selling point, wasn't it?
It was. And because I had that already with my semi-permanent dial-up, it took me a long while, and I was getting that for free because of some jobs and work I was doing at the time. It took me a long while to be convinced that broadband was necessary. But yeah, even with a free, always-on connection, after a certain length of time, it did become necessary to have the high speed, just to do basic things, because whenever we update software, you know, you download a new web browser, 10 megabytes, you know, these days you don't think about that, but on a dial-up connection, that's several hours of downloading.
When you're on dial-up, did you ever have that dilemma about, oh, I just need to download the email, but I'll be really quick, so I'll get off the phone so you can wait for that important call coming in? Oh, it's not there yet. I'll have to get it back on again, and now it's on. You made phone calls in one night.
That was the beauty of the always-on. Yeah.
It was a bit like getting the microwave. Remember when the microwave came out? You said, can't live without that anymore. So, and every household's got one now, I would have thought so. But spare a thought for the guys in the countryside, because like you look at building a website these days, you want actually to be able to send the information to the end user at a relatively fast speed. And because everyone's getting things like video and audio, you know, rich media on their websites, the demand is getting higher and higher. You know, gone are the days of the old text pages where, you know, it's just a little bit of text and a link and it'll take you off. Then all of a sudden, you know, little JPEGs and GIFs, they're the little pictures, came along, and they were nice and lightweight. But at a 56K speed, which we spoke about, that slowed you up a little bit. Then we moved into the world of ADSL, and of course everybody else decided, well, hey, we can start putting sound and things like that on our web pages and have downloads of software and things like that.
And of course, podcasting.
Exactly. And now we're going into, you know, even a website today that I've been working on, we're putting up video clips, 11 mega video clips. And you go, oh, that'll kill the dial-ups. But hey, everyone's on broadband. What the heck these days? So, and then if you think about that, if you're serving 11 megs, let's call it 10 megs in round numbers, that's a big file. You know, that's 10 floppy disks worth of material. Not quite that, but you know what I mean. And by the time that you might get 300 or 400 or 500 people come and download that 10 meg, there's 3 or 4 or 5 gigabytes,
yep,
which is a lot of bandwidth. And that's why the plumbing between us and them, the end user and the server that's serving you the material, needs to lift a little bit in speed. And that's where we've seen this rate of change in the last few years. And that's why we hope the government gets it right when it comes to the rate of change in the forthcoming years, where video on demand, high definition, as you mentioned before, Graham, all that becomes a reality. Are you ready, is what I said in the promo. I think, no, we're not.
To be fair, though, like, you build web pages, you don't think of the dial-up customer when you build them, because you're building something that's for a customer who wants all the fancy features, wants the video, wants the good graphics, the sounds and that sort of thing. You're not going to provide something that's dial-up capable and make it look to a lesser standard than what your competitors would.
Well, it's not a straightforward answer to that. When you're building a website, it really comes down to your target market. Mm-hmm. Yes, what you said is true. If you're thinking about, you know, people in the city and high speed areas, yeah, you don't really think too much about it. But if you were building a website which was going to sell, things to farmers, for example,
tractors or fertilizer or
Something like that, you would think about the target market needs a page which loads relatively quickly on a slow dial-up thing. So in the back of your mind as a web designer, you're thinking, hey, we don't want to put a really high quality video on this site because the poor guys aren't going to be able to download, or it's going to take forever to download.
Or at least you don't put that on the front page, so the front page at least loads, and the user's got a choice then of going for the.
But even still, you look at the big sites like the ABC, you know, you'll get an option of a broadband version or a dial-up version. Yep. And that still caters for the masses that are out there in certain rural areas which aren't as lucky as what we have, and hopefully they won't experience the cherry
picking. Not to mention,
issues.
Look at Google's front page.
Yeah, isn't that great? You know,
don't you love Google's front page?
Yep, definitely.
And they cater for everybody.
That's it. That's right.
You know, Google, the word, a low sort of size JPEG and a field to type in your search query. I love Google, but hey.
When was the last time you put a text-only link on a web page that you designed, Andrew? You don't see that very often these days, do you?
Well, a named anchor.
We used to have little links that just said text-only version.
Yeah, you used to get text-only versions of pages,
yeah. For people with slow links.
Well, it's actually funny you should mention that. I built a government site, which is on air right now, itsyourfuture.com.au, and the only place where we have text links really is in the print versions, where you can click through to print the page out and stuff like that. So it's really, it's still an HTML page, which is what the internet's made of, but it's all formatted nicely.
And yet, for compatibility, in these days of style sheets and the separation of style from content, it should be easier to do that, not harder, and yet people are not doing it.
Mm. Anyway, that's broadband. All happened today.
Yes.
YouTube tests video fingerprints. Top online video service YouTube will soon test new video identification technology with two of the world's largest media companies.
What?
What's this about?
This is a fascinating idea.
Time Warner and Walt Disney. Where have you been, Dr. Ron?
Oh, under a mushroom. Yeah, go on.
YouTube hopes video printing technology will prevent copyright violations across its site. The technology developed by engineers at YouTube, who is owned by Google, will help content owners such as movies and movie houses, TV studios, identify videos uploaded to the site without the copyright owner's permission, making it easy for them to take down.
This is mind-bending technology. I can't quite wrap my head around how they're going to do this. I understand the principle,
but... Yeah, the so-called video fingerprinting tools, which identify unique attributes in the video clips, will be available for testing in about a month.
This is amazing stuff. This is stuff that computers are traditionally really, really bad at, that humans do so easily. To look at two different pictures, they might be a different shape, they might have a lot of interference on one and not on the other, but to recognise that the underlying content is the same, to get a computer to do that, this is a marvellous innovation.
It really is, especially if you think like you might change formats of the video, Graham.
That's right.
And as you said, there might be interference.
Might be running different speed, it might be running different frame rate, it might be...
Might have different colour, saturation, or something like that, and the computer's able to recognise, hang on a minute, this is actually an episode of something that's been on television, there's copyright restrictions, I'm not going to display this.
It's a remarkable thing.
Mm. Interesting. So, good luck to them. Testing it, hope it works all right. There's a lot of things that have been out there that have tried before, like even Photoshop, for example, has a watermark facility, which you can't see, but hopefully identifies the ownership of a picture if people nick it off the web. And
that's a slightly different thing, though. That's not working on actually recognising the content of the picture.
Well, no, that's true, and it's also not a moving picture either,
which this is.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Hopefully it works for
Absolutely.
Them. Absolutely. The US authorities had a bit of a go at MySpace too. Seven convicted sex offenders with profiles on MySpace.com have been arrested in what Texas officials said was the country's first large-scale crackdown of registered offenders who use social networking sites. Now, this has been in the news for all the wrong reasons, not this particular incident, but you know, the social networking sites seem to be a really interesting place for predators to go and you know, look for the poor old unsuspecting souls. But maybe this is the beginning. This is where we're going to start seeing officials actually, you know, keep up with the law in a lot of respects and go out there and catch these guys.
It's good to see some genuine enforcement going on. I think it should happen a lot more often. There's a lot of things go on the internet that if they happened in the real world would be cracked down on very, very quickly. So it's good to see it... that same logic being applied in the online world.
Things happen so fast on the internet as well, and law enforcement agencies are often faced with the most formidable jurisdictional boundaries.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not suggesting it's easy. I'm suggesting it's very, very hard, but
and
we have to make an effort.
Yeah, and good work in this instance.
I think so. For too long, we've put up with this. You know, you look at some of the ISPs and web host companies and things like that, and ignorance is their excuse. Well, I don't think that's the case. If you were driving down the street at the wrong speed, hey, sorry, that's no excuse. You're done. Maybe the tables are turning here too. So that was in Texas. Wonder what will happen over here. Be good, hopefully, if the authorities take heed of it and it becomes a global trend.
Yes.
another thing which happened, apparently the space station's up, the space shuttle's up and they went for a visit to the space station, but there's been a bit of an IT glitch, as Dr. Ron mentioned in the news. Computers that control life support systems aboard the International Space Station have failed, and in the worst case scenario, could force all crew members to come home early. What's going on here? You boys know about this.
The life support got a virus.
What were they doing? Windows machines that didn't... What, a crash or something?
No, we had our tongues firmly in our cheeks when we were talking about Windows updates last week.
I thought they might have opened the window in the space shuttle. That was the problem. No, don't open the window.
No, that's right. Now, they actually unfolded some new solar arrays. The crew of the space shuttle Atlantis went up to the International Space Station. They set up some new solar arrays. And I think what's happened is, as a result of that, it's caused some electromagnetic interference to the computer systems. And a lot of the computer systems actually failed in the new International Space.
Because of the solar arrays?
Yeah, the difficulties were encountered as soon as they had commissioned the new solar arrays.
Ooh.
That's curious.
Did they get a spike, did they?
Well, I think so. They think it's some sort of electromagnetic interference that's causing the computers some grief there. So they've managed to bypass a lot of the fail-safes, I think, in the power supplies, and been actually able to bring up the computer systems that they were having difficulties with. But there was one point there where they were actually using the space shuttle to control using the guidance of the space shuttle to control the International Space Station, because it had no guidance systems.
Crikey.
Oh, God. Not a good spot to be in, is it?
No, it's not a bad spot to be in, mate. And they think that they've sorted everything out and patched it up now to the extent that they're happy for the space shuttle to leave. And its visit has been extended by a day or a couple of days, but it's going to be returning to Earth shortly. So we'll let you know this time next week. Hopefully they'll be safely back on the ground.
Red Rover.
Yeah.
I believe they've patched up the damage to that little blanket on the back of the...
They went out there with their stapler.
They stapled it down. Yeah,
one of the guys did a bit of a spacewalk. Danny Olivas, who's one of the mission specialists, and Jim Riley, they undertook repair work to the thermal blankets.
Is this on the solar array?
No, this is on the space shuttle. On the back of the space shuttle, you know, on the where the tail fin on the space shuttle is, on either side of it, there's these two really big sort of round packs on the back of the shuttle beside the tail fin.
I'll take your word for it.
These contain some thruster packs.
Yeah.
To control the movement of the thing, and they've got a blanket over the top to protect them during re-entry. And that blanket had peeled away in one corner.
Oh, so in re-entry, it could have got very hot.
So it could have been very bad.
Okay.
And they've gone out and stapled it down and made it good again.
So but a stapler and re-entry? Like, you're not talking about the one from the hardware shop down the road, are you? It must be a serious stapler
I'm sure it's an industrial strength NASA version, but I think that's in essence what they did. They had to reattach the
They didn't have to get the number 52 staplers from Officeworks or something, did they? No.
I hope not, but hopefully they think that they've got it all... Yes, bolted down, and they're happy to attempt to return to Earth.
And I guess we'll find out in the next day or so when they come down.
All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about Mark and my sojourn to South Australia.
Looking forward to that.
Which will be a bit of a laugh. But in the meanwhile, while we're on this spacey theme, Adam Turner, who's just sent an email on the computer here. If you want to do that, feedback@techtalkradio.com.au. He's having a bit of a look in the space himself. He's got a telescope by the couch this week.
Adam Turner's View from the Couch on Tech Talk Radio.
Everyone loves an underdog, so there was understandable outrage last year when Pluto was declared not to be a planet. But now everyone's favourite lump of ice has suffered even further indignity. Rather than being the littlest planet, Pluto was last year declared the biggest dwarf planet. But now it's even been stripped of this dubious title. A hunk of rock beyond Neptune called 2003 UB313, or Eris to its friends, has been declared a smidgen bigger than Pluto. Eris even has its own moon, so now it's officially pushed Pluto even further down the list. Pluto was the last of the traditional planets to be discovered, spotted in 1930 by American Clyde Tombaugh as a dim speck moving amongst the stars. It's 6 times smaller than the Earth, and it's even smaller than many of the solar system's moons. It lives amongst a cloud of asteroids known as the Kuiper Belt, and it doesn't even orbit on the same plane as the other planets. Sometimes it's further away from us than Neptune, sometimes it's closer. Clearly, it's the black sheep of the family. Even so, there was an uproar last year when the International Astronomical Union voted to demote Pluto, but the fight to restore the object's honour rages on. PlutoPetition.com is leading the charge. running an online poll to see if people want Pluto restored to its former glory. After 1 million votes, they intend to submit the results to the International Astronomical Union. But so far, it's only 13,000 people who have voted to let Pluto back into the family, with 3,000 voting against. Things look dim for the former ninth planet, as other larger objects will certainly be discovered to push poor Pluto even further down the food chain. The International Astronomical Union will reconvene in 2 years, which is the earliest point at which Pluto's status can be revisited. What Pluto needs is a good PR campaign. If only it had a redeeming feature. I mean, it doesn't have Jupiter's spot or Saturn's rings. Perhaps it could pitch itself as the ultimate holiday destination to really get away from it all. Rest assured, you haven't heard the last of this tiny planet with a big heart. Will the fight for Pluto's honour rage on? You bet your anus it will.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1300 664 882 and leave a voice message. That's 1300 664 882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
A couple of other interesting things that happened during the week, which we're going to talk about very shortly, is Safari made it through to the PC, apparently. PC, though, but and for not from want of trying either, just quietly, Mr. Jobs.
A lot of unhappy campers. You are one of them, Andrew.
Oh, look, we won't talk about that now, but yes. Okay, sorry. Yes, it didn't work. What I'd like to talk about is Mark's and my weekend away. We had a lovely weekend away.
Where did you go?
We went to a place called Mount Gambier. Heard of it?
Yeah, I've heard of Mount Gambier. It's on the border between Victoria and New South Wales.
It is.
Very nice town. Lots of deep holes, though. You got to watch out for the holes.
Very volcanic. Victoria, South Australia, actually.
It's what?
On the border of Victoria and South Australia.
Yes.
New South Wales.
Oh,
it's west, not north, from where we are.
Sorry, did I say New South Wales? I'm sorry. I apologise. Right.
West. Yeah, it's good. But anyway, nonetheless, what it's all about is a really good, fun weekend where you really get to learn how to use technology for the sake of using technology, and no other reason. It's a recreational pastime. So for those who have a need to be in the bush, four-wheel driving, or not even four-wheel driving, in a regular sedan, there are a few of those out there with us as well. It wasn't that impossible. What we ended up doing was, I don't know, how long has it been going for, Mark? It's been a tradition for many years.
I've been going for 20 years, and it's been going a lot longer than that.
So. 20 years, yeah. Well, there's a mob over there called the Southeast Radio Group, and they provide this function, which is a bit of a good boys' weekend away. So you get to take the car, leave the girls behind. There are a few girls there competing on the weekend, those that wanted to, but if you feel the urge to get out and run through the bush, a bit like orienteering.
But we haven't got to the nub of what you were doing. You were hunting down radio transmitters, is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. It's a bit like a glorified hide and seek, except instead of using, like the kids do, they hide something around the house and then they all go off and look for it. This is...
So you go out somewhere outside of Mount Gambier, hide a radio transmitter.
Yes, several radio transmitters. Not just one, many. Okay. Many. And then you have to go find them all.
And then everybody hoons off and tries to track them down.
Yeah, and instead of, as you would sort of think, oh, that sounds pretty boring, let me tell you about the forest in Mount Gambier. And travelling through that, because there's pine plantations, there's beautiful pasture land over there. It's a really very pretty space. There's the beach just down the road a little bit. There's Millicent, all that sort of lovely coastal area. Yeah, there's some two volcanoes there.
Mm-hmm. And you work in teams, Andrew. So
that's right.
You compete against each other. There's a lot of competition between the teams.
That's right.
And when you actually find one of the radio transmitters, do you just hang around and wait for the other teams, or what do you do?
Some you do, yes. If it's just, you just have to find one transmitter, yeah, you find it and you go, well, that was hard, and everyone compares notes and things like that. But when you are hunting successive transmitters, so you find one, then you go and find the next one, and the one after that, and the one after that, it becomes quite an adrenaline rush, especially when you've got other people chasing one and you don't know what's going on. And of course, just picture this, the middle of the night, pitch black, sub-zero temperatures. It's pretty cold in Mount Gambier at the best times. It normally always rains too, and it didn't let us down there either. Fog comes down to ground level beautifully, and you can't see your hand in front of your face. It's just one of those really things. And you're in the car, and you're working together as a team. The driver's sort of looking out for all the obstacles on the road and travelling through the forest at sort of, reasonable speed. And the Beam Swinger is sort of saying, oh, it's coming from this way.
The what?
The Beam Swinger.
What's that?
Good question, actually. That was Mark's role in this incident. He was doing that.
We
what happens?
We had a stretch team, didn't we? Three
we
of
did.
Us from all different teams got together, and it was a great weekend because of it. So, a beam swinger. A beam swinger is the person who turns the antenna that's attached to the car to find the direction of the signal and adjusts the radio and the attenuation so they can get it just at the right level to tell which way it's coming from.
Really, he gives us the direction.
It's so the beam is the antenna.
The beam is the antenna. Yeah, another name for an antenna, like a Yagi, is called a beam.
And you're operating radio equipment to try and find the direction.
Yep, that's right. So we tune it in and adjust the attenuation so you can just hear it. So the only time you can hear it is when it's coming from that direction. The direction
when you've got to point it straight at it.
Yeah, when you're pointing straight
and
at it.
And you tell the driver and the driver drives in that direction?
No, I tell the navigator, which was Andrew's driver.
Yeah, I was navigating.
Andrew's navigating.
You should have seen us. We had laptops everywhere. It was really good. And GPS things plugged into moving map technology. We're all off-the-shelf sort of stuff. In fact, there's a page on the Tech Talk Radio website. If you want to go and have a look, I can't remember the exact URL, but under transcripts on the right-hand side, you'll be able to see some pictures about what we're going to play for you in just a sec. And you can have a look at all the fun
and games. Only one time on the weekend did I tell the driver directly which way to go and found that I got us in trouble and we had to actually drive back out again on another road. So gave up on that idea. Always tell the navigator where the direction of the signal's coming from.
Because you might have the signal coming from a certain direction, but the navigator's the person who's looking at a map and he says, well, to get to that direction...
We turn right when I said turn right, but it was like a dead end. So we basically had to turn left and then go down a street and then turn left again and come back out.
So you really do need to work as a team.
Yeah, very much so.
It is a good team sport. There you go. I've just found on the website. If you go to technology, then click transcripts, then click Radio Sport in Australia.
From our website.
From our website, the Tech Talk Radio website, you'll find out all about it. It's a really good, fun sort of hobby.
I mean, where else would you want to be on a Saturday night, you know, about 0 degrees temperature, you know, late at night, and you're doing, you know, what, 40 to 60 kilometres an hour through a dirt pine forest, you know, with a whole lot of other teams that are sort of, you know, bright lights coming at you from all
and
directions.
The other teams were from South Australia, Victoria, and New South Wales. They came from far afield. It's a bit cold for the Queenslanders. They don't make it down there, but they have had Queensland teams in the past, from recollection.
So yeah, a long way for them to travel.
It is a bit of a drive for the weekend, yes.
How many teams are we talking?
Well, we had 11 participating teams of about, you know, four people per team while we were there. So that was quite a good turnout when you think of it that
way. Years gone by, we've had up to 20 teams. I think the record I saw was 22 teams competed on one hunt one year. So
that's
22
amazing.
Cars with people in them, got a gear.
Does everybody take it in turns to hide the transmitter, or who sets up the course for you?
No, the Southeast Radio Group run the convention and they have all their members take turns to put the transmitter out, usually running it from the car, but at some events required to be on foot as well, so they'll hide it actually in the bush with a person, you know, running a battery-packed radio.
So you get as far as you can in the car and then someone hops out of the car on foot with equipment to find it?
Yeah, a bit similar to what Adam Scammell's come in and done in that orienteering overseas sort of thing, so similar equipment to that.
Yeah, we've got to mention that it is an international sport. There's a lot of interest in it overseas, not just here in Australia. So it's good fun. And if anyone wants to get into it, there's some great opportunities here in Melbourne. There's a monthly hunt that they do from time to time, and I guess there are in some of the other centres as well. You just have to
the on foot stuff that we talked about with Adam, but very big in Europe, but the in car stuff is a lot bigger in the States.
It sounds very similar to a hobby that a lot of listeners might know about called geocaching.
Oh, we ran into the geocaches, didn't we?
Yeah, that's
right. We were sharing a crater with the geocaches.
Well,
and people are going up, did you find it? And they go, yeah. And they were actually geocaches and they didn't realise.
Oh, so you didn't. We've got multiple competitions
there
running.
There was 120 something, but I don't remember there was 120 geocaching people looking or there was 120 geocaches hidden. For the weekend.
If you Google geocache, if you don't know what that's all about, I think it's a very
similar
thing.
You've spoken about this in previous lives, haven't you, Mark?
Yeah, I've tried it out before. So, you know, there's a geocaching website.
It's
and
a great
it
way to
you,
practice with your GPS receiver and so on.
That's right.
Oh, it's a great abuse of technology, really, isn't it?
This is another level on top of geocaching. This is actually using radio transmitters, and you don't know. You've got a map, but you don't know where the thing is. Whereas with geocaching, you know where you're headed.
Yeah, and you get cryptic clues to find it.
It's a bit like Spotto, really, isn't it? All right, here's our report from the weekend. And once again, if you want to have a look on the radio, just go to the Tech Talk Radio site. What did I say? If you want to have a look on the website while we're listening on the radio, techtalkradio.com.au, transcripts, Radio Sport in Australia. So you've got some spare time on your hands and you're looking for a challenge to keep yourself occupied in the coming years.
You love getting into the bush and you like exploring new places. Maybe you have a four-wheel drive and an interest in GPS navigation and radio communications. On the other hand, you may have an interest in orienteering, the sport of finding your way through all sorts of terrain with only a map and a compass, and these days a GPS. Or perhaps you just like socialising with like-minded people who love technology and the great outdoors. If you take everything I've just mentioned and combine them into one sport, you have an event called Radio Sport, or as the regulars like to call it, fox hunting. Now, before you get on your high horse and start ranting and raving about cruel and barbaric sports, there's no furry little critters to be seen anywhere. The fox is a radio transmitter which is hidden somewhere in the bush, anywhere in fact, and the hounds are the teams of runners who go in search of these transmitters. The radio signals from the transmitters concerned can travel many kilometres, and hence the use of a vehicle to get you close certainly saves on the legwork. Teams consist of anywhere from two or more members in one single vehicle, or just a single runner, or hound, if a vehicle isn't necessary. Armed with a radio receiver, a directional radio antenna, a GPS mapping device, and the spirit of adventure with a dash of adrenaline, teams, otherwise known as the hounds, compete to see who can find the fox or hidden transmitter first. Who in their right mind would be involved in such a sport, you might ask? Well, would you believe radio sport is an international competition? Suffice to say that I'm currently standing at the bottom of a volcanic crater in the middle of Mount Gambier in South Australia for the first event of the 2007 Australian Championships. It's a brisk June afternoon, about 10 degrees or so, as about 30 or 40 people prepare to walk or run around the Blue Lake crater in search of 11 hidden radio transmitters. They're holding what they call sniffers, directional radio receivers, which make a high-pitched noise when you're heading in the right direction. Wayne Kilpatrick is the convention coordinator of the Southeast Radio Group's 2007 convention.
They have to find, hopefully they have to find 11 11 transmitters with their sniffers, and they're set throughout the crater lakes in the Blue Lake. Some are up high, some are down low. Some are near water, some are all over the place. And we've allowed them 2 hours, and then they have to complete the event. And if anything is per normal for this particular event, they'll be absolutely exhausted by the time they get back.
Has there been any form of trickery involved in this, or is it just relatively straightforward so anyone could do it?
No, everybody knows that when we set the course, it's always legit. There's never two transmitters on the same frequency. To confuse the issue, that would just be totally unfair. But no, there is a bit of skullduggery goes on, because knowing amateurs, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. And if you have two, without giving too much away, but if you have two transmitters, one's up high and one's down low, and they think of a straight line, some of the straight lines are very steep.
What size area is the playing field here today?
Yeah, we've got 11 transmitters going in an area of about 5 square kilometres, right throughout the Valley Lake as part of the Blue Lake, which is part of the Blue Lake complex. So if they look at the Blue Lake complex, not the big lake, but the other area to the side of it, they'll see what that is. And yeah, it's a fantastic venue. There's barbecues, wildlife parks. Who knows? I don't think any of the guys tied anything on an emu or something. So, but I suspect that there'll be a hit of transmitter in there somewhere.
After a brief run-through with the competitors on what to expect, Wayne unceremoniously started the event, sending the waiting masses off into the volcanic bush with the quest of finding 11 transmitters within the allotted 2 hours.
So when the boys have got their 2 hours to do this, the 11 transmitters, any points they get from this event, they will absolutely earn.
What do you expect the attrition rate to be on this one?
Oh, I would say about 50%. I don't think, I don't want to put them down, but I suspect that if they can find, of the 11, if they can find 6 of them, 50% of them find 6 of them, I'll be pretty pleased with that.
Adam Scammell was the first to complete the course, finding all 11 transmitters. Spirits were high with a good sense of humour as the first event concluded.
What was it like out there?
I had a good time. Yeah, it was quite challenging. It was I had a GPS I was running with just to get an idea of how far I travelled, but unfortunately it was off for about 30% of the time, so I really don't know. But I come across a cliff fairly early, which was a bit daunting. Decided to turn around and attack that one later from a different angle.
So how did you go on the flats? Did you spend a lot of time at one altitude, or were you going up and down the hills all the time?
I tried to get what I could without, climbing, etc. So I made sure that the outer ones that were up the top, I got them towards the end, and once I was up there, I stayed up there. So it made for a long run all the way around the outside, but I think it helped.
Now, you're fairly fit and, well-dressed for the occasion. Do you think anyone who's not quite that way built would enjoy it just as much as you did?
Yeah, I got mentioned to me at the start that it was going to be a runner's course. It was a mountain goat type thing, so I figured it would sort of benefit us, whereas maybe some of the teams with older competitors or, the heavier competitors might struggle a bit.
The Saturday night hunt is what makes the team's trek to Mount Gambier. This year, there are entrants from South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales. The evening hunt starts at 8 p.m. and sees teams cover anywhere from 150 to 400 kilometres, depending on how good their equipment and navigation is. The town of Mount Gambier itself is a bustling country town, which is home to several thousand hectares of pine plantations. It's also not far from the coast and has lush green farmland and some amazing volcanic attractions. This in itself makes it ideal countryside for such an event. The night hunt has five transmitters to find in a specific order. As the teams arrive for the start, the air of excitement starts to get the adrenaline pumping. Brian Ackerley from Melbourne is a member of the defending champions team.
Brian, how confident are you feeling tonight?
reasonably.
There's a hell of a lot of technology here in front of you. What does it all do?
Well, no, I think it's where do I start? We've got a little GPS mapping thing here, which is not really terribly useful. We've got automatic attenuation, which just as we get closer to the transmitter, it just automatically cuts the signal back and tells you how much by, so you don't need to worry about flicking switches. The rest of it's pretty standard, just a meter to show your signal strength.
The night hunt, would that be one of your favourite hunts when you come over to Mount Gambier?
Absolutely, yeah. It's like the pinnacle event almost. It's the one that sort of, it almost makes and breaks the whole thing. If you do well in the night hunt, you usually can, you're going to do fairly well for the whole event.
How long do you reckon we'll be out here for tonight? We've got, 2:70, 2, 6 and 10. There's five legs.
Yeah, that's right. Probably, not that many years ago, we used to wonder whether we'd find them all in the time that was allotted to us. Now we expect to be able to do that, but the issue is going to be just in how long. I think in a couple of hours to do all five legs probably is about, I think we'd do it in about that time. I think the best teams should normally do it in about that time.
Steve Howe.
How prepared are you for the night hunt this evening?
Oh, it's all working at the moment.
How confident are you for the evening?
It looks like it's going to work. It worked this afternoon, so hopefully we don't get any blips. It worked quite well, actually. So considering that it's a brand new laptop, and nothing was really prepared much in the forefront, but it's come out really well.
And what technology are you running here? Just really the mapping software, anything else?
We're running a homegrown control program for the mapping, which controls the PCR1000, plotting of lines, the snail trail, reading in and interpreting GPS.
But you've got to admit, with all this technology, there's still a hell of a lot of luck involved in this sport, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, it's all luck. You find the guy with the cheapest equipment can sometimes win, so yeah.
Righto, about 100 metres to go, we're turning left.
It's not long before the teams are on their way in search of the five hidden transmitters, which are hidden many kilometres apart. It's this night hunt which really brings out the teamwork needed for success. The driver keeps a careful eye on the roads and terrain as the beam turner calls the direction from which the signal is coming from.
10:30. All right, keep going straight across.
Left?
Left or right?
Straight ahead, if that makes sense.
No, it doesn't.
It's according to the map, it's a crossroad.
Bearings all over the place.
Don't go left. It'll be a right and then a left or something. We just can't see it. There you go.
Yeah.
The navigator then pulls all the information together to try and get the team to the Fox using the most direct route. That's the theory, at least. Like in any sport, there's team rivalry, which means there's no amount of tricks and decoys to try to distract others who may be following close behind. GPS navigation is absolutely essential to pinpoint exactly where you are in the pitch-black South Australian pine forests. And to add an extra element of excitement to what is already an action-packed night, thick fog, with the consistency of a good pea soup, descends on the forest floor, making visual navigation almost impossible. The what seems like sub-zero environment also adds to the challenge of the Mount Gambier night hunt. After 2.5 hours, the first team successfully finds all 5 transmitters. But it's not until after midnight that all teams have completed the course. The night hunt never goes without some form of incident, and tonight was no different. One team managed to get well and truly bogged, and another just ran out of petrol.
So tell us what happened last night in the paddock out there where you got bogged.
It was tragic. We'd come through, we'd finished, we were going home, and then we'd already been through this little bog and back again, and we had to go through it again, and we decided to go a little bit too far to the right, and we should have gone that far to the right, but, well, we went a bit too far, and we got in a little bit tentative, and speed is of the essence when you come to travelling through bogs, and we didn't have enough of it, and a little application of brakes and that sort of...
So you had a sinking feeling, did you?
Yeah, only on one side. And getting out and having a look, yes, it has sunk. Highway road pressure in the tyres probably didn't assist that little thing, but anyway, it was a beautiful evening to sit out there and contemplate the evening, which we did.
How long were you out there before rescue arrived?
It'd be about 15 to 20 minutes. It would normally have been longer, but the rescue vehicle... is very fleet of foot.
And what was the conversation like in the vehicle in that 15 to 20 minutes?
It was sporadic, loud and quiet, quite friendly. A few attempts made to jam pieces of wood under the wheels for traction and things like that, but to no avail.
Bruce, you ran out of petrol last night. What happened?
Basically that. We realised on about the second last hunt, Di said, our driver said, we seem to be getting a bit low on fuel. I didn't notice it at the start of a hunt. Anyway, well, we thought we'd keep going, and we had the yellow light go on about 10 minutes to go into the final leg. We thought, well, we're probably better off finding a fox and all the other people who have found it, and then we've got someone who can go and get fuel for us rather than trying to get home on our own. So we kept on persevering. We had all sorts of trouble with our equipment, so we couldn't get a good direction, but we finally found the fox, and we only went about 3 km past the fox going home, and we conked out.
So tell me a little bit about the conditions last night. It was mighty brisk.
Yes, it was, but it doesn't really matter in the car. You can have the heater going, and it's quite comfy.
Except when you run out of petrol.
Except, well, yes, it's true. When the windows just fog up.
The National Australian Fox Hunting Championships are certainly something to behold and to compete in. There are several local competitions run in various states around Australia on a regular basis. Most groups are actively seeking new members and teams. So if this sort of fun is for you, then why not give it a go? You'll need a vehicle of sorts, some amateur radio gear and a GPS. A zest for a bit of adventure is also mandatory. Contact your local amateur radio club for more details or the Wireless Institute of Australia. And the 2007 winner? Congratulations to Brian's team again for the 3rd year in a row. I'm Andrew McComb for Tech Talk Radio.
So there you go. That was what we did on the weekend, boys.
Aren't well,
you
glad you had like a lot of fun?
Oh, look, the thing that amazes me, you can have all that technology and the and the petrol light comes on and there's not a cracker you can do about it.
It sounds like organised chaos, Andrew. People driving everywhere. You're yelling at people saying, go straight ahead. And they're going, no, we can't go straight ahead. And
it was a T-intersection.
It's a
go straight ahead at the T-intersection.
It sounds like you worked it out, though.
Well, it's pitch black and your lights don't show you that there's a road slightly to the right about 30 metres over. You just can't see it.
And the fog,
it, you
know? And it's like, oh, there it is over there. So, you know, and then you run out of map because some of the maps are a little bit old, or there's a big black void on the right-hand side where it becomes Victoria, for example, and that's it. You just go, may the force be with you, young navigator, and off they go. But no, it was a lot of fun.
Nice chance to chat to Brian Ackerley, who we've had on before with the AA battery comparison.
That's right. Yes, that was Brian.
And
yes.
Adam Scammell, who's talked about radio orienteering before.
Yep, they're all available with downloads on the website if you want to know a little bit more about it. But if you want to come along one night, you know, and you've got that zest for enthusiasm, you would certainly be welcome, even if you come along as a passenger, just try and get in touch with some of these guys. Plenty of websites to do that, plenty of people to have a look, even through ours. There's a lovely photo of you, Mark, on the webpage there, putting up an antenna.
80-metre antenna.
Yeah, just in the foot of the there's lovely trees in the background there. So go and have a look, and you'll know exactly what we're talking
about. Funny story, just a quick one.
Yep.
One of the teams decided to use Google Earth Plus this year. On their, to do their tracking. So we
as
have
their
this
mapping software.
As their mapping software. So mm-hmm. we use things like Figawi and Aussie Explorer is another one. But
these are all software programs you can download off the internet.
And you know, you have topographic maps on them. Well, this team decided this year they'd try Google Earth. But you buy Google Earth Plus for about $20-$25 US, and then it will track on there. But you've got the satellite images, which is, you know, really good, show you actually where the tracks are in the pine forest a bit better. That was their theory. So they downloaded a gigabyte of maps because it all gets cached onto your PC.
Because you can.
Yeah, because you can. So they did that on the Thursday night, only to find that when they actually purchased Google Earth Plus, all of that gets scrapped. And they had nothing on their So do you reckon this is fair use policy? They paid $10 for their internet connection at their hotel and downloaded 400 megabytes.
Yeah, that's fair use. It's all in the name of science, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Very good.
So there you go, everybody. That's an abuse of technology, which is a lot of fun, and I highly recommend it to anybody, especially if you like getting out in the bush and playing with all that sort of stuff. It really is good fun. All right, moving right along.
Hang on, well, before you move on. Where did you guys come in the final results?
Oh, you want to know how we did? What did we get? Third out of 11th, didn't we, over the overall?
Oh, it's not too
fourth.
Bad.
Now we came fourth overall.
Did
and
we?
Second
fourth.
On the night hunt, which we're absolutely chuffed about.
Yeah, that
we?
Was a bit of fun, that one.
Mm-hmm. And we got a couple of other firsts on other events. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, congratulations.
There you go. So the Tech Talk Radio team did reasonably well over there.
Very good.
Come and join us next year. It'll be a lot of fun. I don't know who to... Yeah, you guys go and we'll stay here and do the show. No.
Yeah, all right. Deal. Yeah. Done.
Thank you to our driver, Greg Williams, who we've had on before as well as our legal representative.
Sounding a bit nepotistic now, isn't it?
It was the TikTok radio team.
Oh, it was
it?
Indeed. It was. Yeah. Yes. Now, moving right along, Mr. Jobs announced Safari for Windows during the course
this
of the
is
week.
This is Apple with their web browser. This is the big web browser that Apple use on their Macintosh operating system.
Big? Well, they're after 25% market share.
Thereafter, that's not what they've got yet.
No, but that's what they're aiming for.
Yep.
So they figure that because they've got PC users by the short and curlies with iTunes and QuickTime, they reckon, oh, let's throw something else at them. So they've delivered up Safari, which is a very good browser. I'm not going to say either way. I've used it before. It seems quite good. And now you can run it on the new version of Mac and on the Windows XP
and on Windows, yeah, that's right.
Now the fastest web browser available, according to Apple.
Yeah, that's a bit of spin. like Senator Coonan saying broadband's good in this country.
So what was your experience like?
Well, you did come over on the weekend. I did show you what my XP box thought of...
And I said, have you got text turned off? I can't read anything on the webpage.
No, there's a few pictures and that's it. So it is a beta version, as Graham rightly pointed out.
It didn't work for you, though.
No, it didn't work. It put some lovely pictures on there. It looked very Mac-ish. I thought, oh, this is new. I know they're wanting to go icon-based driven, but there's no text at all. That's a bit of a giveaway.
And you went to type a different address into the title bar, but there was no text when you were typing either.
No.
Oh, white on white, was it?
Well, I installed it on
my... The cursor moved, to be quite honest. Sorry, you had success, did you, Graham?
I installed it on my Windows XP machine, and it worked perfectly for me. It didn't put a foot wrong.
You're a Firefox user, Graham,
I'm
usually.
Also a Firefox user. I got Firefox on it as well.
Was there a discernible difference in the speed?
Well, I didn't I didn't run them one up against the other to do a definite measurement of it.
But you weren't blown away by, wow, this is super fast.
Well,
I'm using Safari.
It felt fast.
Did it?
Yeah. I did notice that it felt fast.
They're saying it's about twice as fast. Well, it's considerably faster than Internet Explorer.
That's right.
And just marginally faster.
So I don't know how true that is. It's going to depend on your connection and what sort of content it is and all that sort of stuff. Because it's only going to be faster rendering the content once it's got it. If you're having trouble getting the content to you, then it's not going to make any difference whatsoever.
So if you want to give it a bash... being the word,
yeah.
Live on the edge, live on the beta edge.
And remember that it is a test version.
Go to apple.com/Safari, I think will do it for you. In the meanwhile, whilst you're typing that into your keyboard, let's hear from Mr. Jobs himself about the new version of Safari for the Windows.
Well, we dream big. We would love for Safari's market share to grow substantially. That's what we'd love. But how are we going to do that? Well, the Mac's market share is growing, and this is great. But we want to grow maybe even in addition to that. And to do that, we're going to have to create a version of Safari that runs on Windows. We have a little bit of expertise in doing that because of iTunes. And that's exactly what we have done. We now have Safari, the latest and greatest version, Safari 3, running on Leopard. Safari 3 now runs on XP and Vista as well. They exist today. How do they work? Well, one of the most important things, of course, we're bringing all of the Safari innovations over to Windows because it is the best browser in the world. But what about speed? How does it measure up? How good are we at bringing apps to Windows? Well, let's take a look. iBench, most respected browser benchmarks there are, publicly available. Let's take a look at HTML performance on Windows XP. Three browsers, Internet Explorer, Firefox, and Safari, all running on the same machine, same Windows XP. How do they do in these tests? Obviously, faster is better. To run through the iBench HTML performance suite, 4.6 seconds on Internet Explorer, Firefox 3.7, Safari 2.2, over twice as fast as IE. Let's take a look at JavaScript. Another very important thing. Internet Explorer to run the iBench JavaScript suite, 2.4 seconds. Firefox, 1.6. Safari, under a second. So, what we've got here is the most innovative browser in the world, but we've also got the fastest browser on Windows. Twice as fast as IE, 1.6 times faster than Firefox 2. Google and Yahoo search built in. It is the same technology as Safari on Leopard.
So there you go, the launch of Safari as delivered by Apple's CEO, I think he is, Mr. Jobs himself. And Graham, what do you reckon? Do you reckon it's got a chance because you've used it? Is it going to be fast enough for you?
Well, I installed it out of curiosity.
That's what I did too. My curiosity is still
I've got no reason to use it other than curiosity. Firefox does very well for me, and Internet Explorer as well. I use both of them regularly. I'm wondering why I need a third browser.
Yes. Now, I wonder the same thing too, and as a developer, I go, oh, no, not another one.
Well, that's the other problem.
Because all browsers are different, aren't they? They like that showing things
do,
a little differently
sadly,
along the line. So, anyway, I guess that's life. Dr. Ronnie, you bravely go into these sort of, you know...
Sometimes
you walk on the edge, you're going to go give it a whirl. Well, you're the only person I know who's installed ME for the Windows system, but...
ME? No, yeah. I know, the Media Center edition.
Oh, Media Center, yeah. That's what I'm thinking of, yeah.
Give ME a wide berth. Safari, I'm a little bit anxious about Safari, only because of my experience with iTunes on the PC. It's a great music...
You have that takeover experience,
This
feeling.
This is the problem, yeah. It's a great catalogue system, but it takes over a lot of functions that I don't want it to take over.
Now, this brings me to an interesting point, because I haven't installed iTunes on my computer for exactly that reason, because I didn't want it to take over my music catalogue. But when I installed Safari...
What's wrong with Macintosh world domination?
When I installed Safari, it installed this Apple software updater to keep Safari up to date. And it did. When the patch came out for the security fixes, it told me about that and downloaded and installed it for me. But it also tried to install iTunes.
Yes. I know. Well, this is what I'm worried about, Graeme, because I know...
What installed iTunes? The updater?
The updater tried to install iTunes, which I don't already have, and that really annoyed me.
Yeah,
well, it's like adware, isn't it?
It is.
Well, legal form of adware. We're going to get you in the end.
I use iTunes as a music catalogue system, but I know that if I shut down iTunes and expect it to be closed and gone away, if I open up my task manager, I'll find
you've seen
got
a little watcher
running.
Thing there.
I've got iPod server running. I've got iTunes helper running. I've got all this garbage. I've got iPod something else service running that I don't use and I don't want running there. It's taking up valuable computer resources.
Exactly.
And I'm anxious that if I put this new browser on the system, certainly on a production system, one that's important to me, it's going to take over and I'm going to have all this whole world of browser pain like I do now with iTunes when it comes to managing my music.
Well, there you go, everybody. Give it a whirl. Send us an email. Let us know. feedback@techtalkradio.com.au or visit the forum and let us know how you go with...
If you've had an experience
Safari.
With it, yeah, give us a post on the forum there and share your experience with everyone.
Absolutely.
All right, when we return, Microsoft plugging a few more holes. That's what they do these days.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one. Visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step 2, click subscribe and you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work, visiting the relatives, washing the car.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Everyone's now got their GPSs out in the studio. Navman's out. See, it's inspired everybody, hasn't it? Dr. Ron, you've got a couple of Cheerios there for the, what do you call it? The Frapper and the stream and
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, the little forum-y thing. Yeah, it's GPS city here now, isn't it? That last story inspired everybody.
It did, indeed.
If you haven't registered as a user on the forum, you should. Go to forum.techtalkradio.com.au. Talk to us. And share all your experiences with technology there. Hello to some new users, Grontix.
Who? Grontix.
Grontix. And Erofi. I'm not sure exactly how you pronounce that. John W. is a more conventional username. Excellent.
Welcome aboard, everybody.
And hello to a new user there as well. Adam Turner signed up.
Oh, really?
Yes. Good work, Adam. It's
well
good
done,
to
Adam.
Have
how long has it taken? Yeah.
He's been spying on us there for a while now on the forum. And also, hello to Eugene, who rang earlier when we were setting up all our equipment here, and it was frantic. Sorry I couldn't chat to you, Eugene, but send us a post there on the forum, and if you've got some issues with your computer, we'll try and help you out.
Yeah, that's the best way.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, let's have a chat about Microsoft, the large organization that powers 90% of the world's computers. Microsoft released four critical software patches to plug security holes in several versions of its Windows operating system, Internet Explorer, and some other programs. Graham, you probably know a bit about this. The patches that carried Microsoft's highest security warning are all to prevent malicious hackers from remotely taking control of computers without permission. Is this because when they write it, they don't foresee a lot of these things coming, and it's just because some nice person's gone, hey, look at this?
Yeah, that's right. Windows and the various applications that run under Windows are horrendously complicated computer programs. And either the programmer makes a mistake, or there's some unforeseen
set
of circumstances.
Not that they make mistakes, though. It's just that someone left the door open and you can sneak in. It's a bit like unlocked the wireless.
Something like that, yeah.
They cater for every possibility, I guess, when they're developing these applications.
That's right.
Sometimes they're generally allowed, aren't they? They're designed in there to
Design.
For some other application, and someone finds about the fact that they could be exploited.
A peculiar way to misuse a feature, yeah. Mm. So there's all of these issues, and it's not just Microsoft that this happens to. It's just Microsoft that we end up talking about all the time because they're so prominent in our computing lives. But all the various versions of Linux and so on, and Macintosh operating system and all the others, they all have the same issues. It's important to just keep your computer up to date, because as soon as Microsoft published the fix for these problems, it's also told the bad guys exactly what the problems are.
It's a bit of a catch-22, isn't it, whether to actually publish the vulnerability that everyone's aware of it and everyone updates their system, or to keep it quiet.
But then you're keeping the bad guys informed as well.
This is the problem.
What do you
yeah.
do? What comes first? The horse before the cart type sort of scenario?
Well, hopefully, if people are doing the right thing, when people discover these problems, they report them privately to Microsoft instead of publicly announcing them on bulletin boards and things like this.
Which we have seen in the past.
To give Microsoft a chance to fix them before they become widely known. Sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes they become widely known before there's a chance to fix them, and then Microsoft are under the pump to get a fix out really quickly. Mm. Once the fix comes out, you can guarantee that the bad guys know about the problem. So leaving your computer unpatched is going to be a really dangerous situation. So I'd encourage people, even though there have been the odd problems with Windows updates causing other things to go wrong on computers, you're generally safer installing them than leaving them out.
Dr. Ron, how's your updates going? You tend to leave them go for some time and then spend whole weekend days. Trying to get your machine back up and running. And I'm surprised from an IT guru like your good self.
What? Yeah, it's easy to fall into bad habits though, isn't it? And you think, yeah.
Is that because your machine's never on at 3 in the morning when it does it automatically in background?
No, that issue I had was with a Linux server, and what was I trying to do, Graham? I can't even remember now. It's something I was trying to do, but it required me to install some updates.
Oh, that's right. You were putting
up your blog software.
WordPress on.
That's
WordPress.
Right. I was putting WordPress on.
That was only a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that's right.
Amnesia was one of those bad experiences, was it?
A few weeks ago is a long time in technology. And yeah, I was trying to install the latest SQL Server modules and all these techy things. And then the problem is it starts to snowball. If you miss one and then miss a couple or miss a few, you can't just put the one module on you need. It ends up there's 2 or 3 dozen different modules that need to be installed and upgraded.
And that's because you hadn't been maintaining your Linux server.
That's right, Graham. That's right. That's the reason.
I reckon. Sorry to say it.
No, don't be sorry to say it. I serve purely as a warning to people.
How would you be being Google? Because they're all Linux-based servers and they must have plenty of them, more than 42, despite what Adam Lasnik says. Imagine when they roll out a patch, all their servers don't
update. Absolutely. But on the other hand, they've got the... presumably they're 42,000 or 42 million or however many servers they've got. They've got a test lab that's set up exactly the same way as all of those 42 million production units, so they can test them first and then roll them out.
They can see what will happen when they apply those upgrades and make sure there are no unforeseen problems.
And the other thing that no doubt they do is they have lots and lots of identical machines, so it's not quite so big a job as you might think.
Well, speaking of big jobs, Google is hosting a Linux summit. You'd be interested in this. The high priests of open source software have congregated at Google's headquarters to debate the future of the movement and face down recent patent threats by Microsoft. Like the way it shows linking tonight. It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Linux movement has long favoured the penguin as its mascot too, by the way, which is good.
Do you know its name, by the way?
No.
It's called Tux.
Is it?
That penguin.
Yeah. It wears a tuxedo, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah. TUX.
But leading names of Linux, the world's biggest grassroots software phenomenon, are spending 3 days to deliberate and debate about open source and how they should fight the threat from the incumbent Microsoft, because Microsoft have had a few patents saying, I think you're nicking a few of our ideas type sort of thing. So
yeah,
it's a bit skullduggerish.
None of which have been tested, by the way.
No, but everyone can rattle a cage and get out there and jump up and down. I guess these guys are just doing that. Because Google, everything Google does is on Linux. It's all open source. And that's the difference, really, as we discussed, I think, on the after the Developers Day, the difference between what open source can offer as opposed to what closed source, if there is such a word, down the other way offers.
There is. And I think we need both forms of software development to move the industry forward. I think there's definitely a place for both sides of the fence in this one.
I guess you've got to look at things like OpenOffice. I've never seen it. You guys use OpenOffice.
Oh, yeah.
How does that resemble Microsoft's Office?
Very closely.
So maybe that's what they've got their nose out of joint about, that maybe, hey, guys, this is going to be too close.
Well, maybe. That's not actually part of the Linux kernel. It's a separate GPL project.
Yeah.
I imagine that's one of the other projects that Microsoft mentioned. But Microsoft have said that there's actually stuff in Linux kernel itself that they might have a patent on. But it's all untested as yet, and yet they're signing up agreements with Linux distributors to protect them, to get money to protect themselves from legal action. So
who is?
Microsoft are signing up agreements with Linux distributors.
Really?
Like Novell and several others. To protect themselves against action under these patents.
How bizarre is this?
So Linux distributors are paying Microsoft to distribute Linux, which is free.
So in a couple of years' time, this is going to be great. I'm going to really enjoy IT in about 5 years' time. Bandwidth is going to be free and plentiful.
Yay.
Software is going to be free and cheap. And you're only going to have to pay for your downloads if you go and log on to a video shop and download something or whatever you buy online.
And pigs will fly.
Yeah, exactly. dear. Now, speaking of that, Sol Trujillo welcomes...
I agree with you.
That's an unkind link.
No, the way the show's linking.
That's a very unkind link.
It's going well. Carry on.
Sol Trujillo, who...
Sorry,
runs,
the last story for the evening.
Who runs Telstra.
Yes, that's right. He welcomes the government end to a fibre jam. Telstra head Sol Trujillo has told staff that he welcomes the government's decision to appoint a panel charged with breaking the fibre to the node deadlock, but it has no plans to negotiate over a rollout. In a letter
letter to Telstra workers, Sol said, on balance, I think it's a good sign because the government apparently sees the need to break the regulatory logjam that it is now stopping at deploying the fibre to the node.
But on the other hand, he's not going to talk to them.
Yeah, you go figure.
Next.
Dear. Anyway, one last thing I want to have a bit of a chat to you boys about tonight is eBay.
Oh, yes.
Are you guys eBay users? I think we all sort of have a bit of a go from eBay from time to time. There's a great new little facility on it. I'm actually trialling on the moment. My auction ends in about 45 minutes, so I better do a refresh. I've got a bid in here. Trying to buy a GPS.
We'll talk amongst ourselves.
Trying to buy a GPS here because you've got me all in spot.
Saw how well it worked on the dash.
Oh, I was very impressed, very impressed.
Said I'm going to have one of those.
But they've got a new, well, it's new to me, but I just thought I'd tell everybody about it. There's a feature called Bid with Bid Assistant. Have any of you guys used the Bid Assistant on eBay?
No.
It's a, say for example, you're looking for one specific object, like I'm looking for a Bluetooth GPS here, and there's hundreds of them on eBay. Well, maybe 50 of them or something.
Hundreds of them in the studio here at the moment.
Yeah, we have. We've got the world cornered. And what you can do is you can actually select all the auctions that you want to participate in and say to eBay, hey, this is as much as I want to pay for any one of these. Go bid for me. And eBay will then go and bid on all the ones that you tick until it actually wins an auction for you. So you can say, okay, I'm prepared to pay $40 for something. And it goes, auction one, that's next. I'll bid on this one on your behalf. No, sorry, you missed out. Moves down to the next one, which is the same item, obviously, well, different seller. And it has a bit of a bid for you there. It says, no, sorry, didn't win that one either. Oh, but here, third one, we've won that one. And then it deletes bidding for all the other ones that you've tried to.
You hope.
Hope? No, that's what they... Guaranteed.
Guaranteed.
So you won't end up with five of the same item. That's the worry
That's the worry. But as long as you're not playing for sheep stations, I guess that's not really an issue. But I thought that was really
it's a good feature in eBay.
Especially
for the busy person who doesn't want to be there for every auction. And
well, especially when your auction ends at 3 a.m. and you don't want to get up to, put another one in.
Start again tomorrow. You know?
Third-party sniping type applications and websites that you can go to for quite a while now.
By sniping, you mean that it puts a bid in right at the very last second? Is that
That's it. You tell it when the auction's going to end, or you give it the item number, and it'll go off and it'll monitor it for you.
I've been gazumped by those guys in the past trying to buy stuff on eBay.
What, they've failed you, have they?
Yeah, or? I've missed out because someone's come in and bid with 1 second to go. Yeah,
I think there's a bit of an art on eBay doing that, isn't it?
There is, yeah.
Have you had success with these guys, Dr. Ron, or you just...
I haven't used them. I'm aware of them, but no, I haven't used them myself.
And you have to pay them, do you?
Do you?
I don't know. I don't think so.
So what do they get out of it? Ads on this website or something?
Yeah, okay. Or exposure and that sort of thing. Yeah, if you've used one of those sorts of applications, let us know on the forum.
That'd be good. All right, back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Son of a...
Okay, we can put all the gadgets away here in the studio tonight. The GPSs have gone away. We've been trying to sync them to everything known to mankind in here tonight. I have a gadget for you, boys.
Excellent.
What's the gadget?
A GPS receiver.
No. No, hang on. I'll just check eBay. I'm going well in this auction. Let me just tell you, a USB portable paper shredder. Now, you've had everything now for your USB device. Now you can get a paper shredder for your USB device. You don't have to wait until you clean out your desk or home anymore, though. This is Brando's new USB paper shredder. All you need is a spare USB port. I suspect all it does is takes 5 volts out of the little plug on the side there.
I dread to think what would happen if you put too many bits of paper in at one time, you know.
Or the paper clip, for that matter.
Yeah,
bit of sticky tape, gum up the works or anything
that's
like it. That. But, you know, there's been USB stubby coolers, there's been USB fish tanks, there's been USB this and that.
USB rocket launchers. Don't forget the rocket launcher.
Lava lamps.
That's right. LARP. I've got two of those. Yes. They make great night lights for the kids, let me tell you. But there you go. That's the Tech Talk Radio gadget for the week. Why not go out and lash out and get yourself... Because we all need paper shredders for privacy, as you've said, Dr. Ron. Get rid of those funny little unsolicited things you've got. So now you can get one and plug it into your...
Identity theft is a big issue.
Yes, now you can plug it into your USB port and you won't have any problems with identity theft.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
And just because you can, the Tech Talk Radio website of the week this week is for Google tips. And I came across this and I couldn't resist the name of the actual, how'd you call it, the website. It's called Dumb Little Man. And they have a thing called Tips, Tips for Life. And there's the 20 tips for more efficient Google searches. Because haven't we all come to the point in life where we want to actually find something on Google the first time around and you don't know how to enter it when you're looking for something specific?
Yeah, you can do really good things with Google searches if you know how to use your quotes and your plus signs and whatever else you can do.
You can type keywords in at the start with and then put a colon and then other and then you
yep, you can limit the search to particular sites.
Yeah, that's it.
Exactly. Well, this site here will tell you, you know, they've got 20 tips here of how you can actually make things work a little bit better for you for using quotes and the not similar and the tilde sign, which are similar terms and wildcards, advanced operators, definitions, and something here that I didn't know about, but maybe that's just because I'm showing my age. Did you know that there's a music search now on Google? You can put music colon and search for something and it brings back music lyrics and things like that.
Didn't they? For lyrics or for actual music files?
I don't think it's music files. It says the music operator returns content related to music only.
Oh, there you go.
You learn something every day on the show. I was zipping through there and I thought, oh, that's got to be interesting. So there you go. Good. For people looking for lyrics, if you didn't know what the name of that Beatles song was, you can type something starred on Beatles and music and things like that in front of it and you'll be able to work it out. You want the URL, I can tell that's what you're looking at. It's one of those funny little ones, and I'll put it up on the website, but if you go to www.dumblittleman.com, I don't know where they got the name of it. It was just intriguing when I found it.
Work your way through from there.
Work your way through the site, or we'll put a link on our webpage, which will take you directly to the page concerned.
There is a fine line between genius and madness. Showtime.
Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Andrew, you're all for alternative technology.
Alternative energy, carbon neutral.
You've done some experiments with solar panels and things like that in your time. Chinese farmer has made his own solar-powered water heater.
Yeah. We've got them on the roof here at the moment, haven't we? A solar-powered water heater?
Maybe. He's made his own solar-powered water heater out of 66 beer bottles and hose pipes. I invented this for my mother. I wanted her to shower comfortably, said Ma Yanyun.
And it's nothing to do with him wanting to drink the 66 bottles of beer.
Maybe it was, Graham. Maybe maybe after he consumed...
Had to get his inspiration from somewhere.
Maybe he consumed 66 bottles of beer and said, oh, I know what I can do.
It's the sort of thing that would seem like a good idea after consuming that quantity of beer.
Is there some things...
I thought he would have started consuming before he got the idea, but nonetheless, his friend did it.
The bottles are attached to each other as the water flows through the bottles slowly while being heated up by the blazing sun. This energy source might be free, but it isn't a pretty sight. There you go. That's the Tech Talk Radio Odd Spot.
It's brilliant use of technology.
Yes. Yeah, well, at least it's not flushing mobile phones down toilets, which you guys were talking about.
That was...
Was that the POMs in the UK had... we missed this, Mark, as I look at Mark across the other side of the studio.
230,000 a year or something?
Oh, it was more than that. It was 885,000, wasn't it?
Oh, was it? Was it?
No.
It might have been, Graham. I haven't got the number in front of me. It was a huge amount, though. Yeah.
All right. You've been listening to everyone here tonight, full house tonight for Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, Mark Diggins, and myself, Andrew McComb. We will return again same time on your radio next week. And with more of the same, well, actually, slightly different flavoured normally, but stick with us and hopefully we'll give you a bit of a better understanding about where technology's going and all that sort of stuff too. So thanks to everyone. Thanks to Adam, who contributes on a regular basis. And there'll be more of Adam next week. And rumour we might have Microsoft on the show very shortly too. We're going
to look forward to that.
Talk about office-y things and XML files. So that'll be a bit of fun.
Excellent. The new document formats.
May not be next week, maybe the week after. But anyway, there'll be some Microsoft on very shortly. So stay with us.
Hit the feedback, hit the forum. Yep. Let us know what you think.
Thanks for visiting, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye for now.
Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Sir Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins. Our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities are courtesy of Evolving Communications, podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The producers wish to thank all the stations that are taking the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM and 4KZ. For syndication, sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.